Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is The Enchantress of Florence. Earlier novels include Midnight's Children, Satanic Verses, Haroon, and The Sea of Stories. More recently, Fury and Shalimar the Clown. Enchantress of Florence brings us back to, in a way, your roots in magic realism and history. What brought you back to this earlier genre?
For a start, it's very interesting to go back to the beginning of your own form. You know, I mean, that this is a moment at which fiction, often written as long narrative poetry, was really just coming into something like the shape that we now understand. And of course, the poems, the long narrative poems like Orlando Furioso and so on, are filled with the fantastic. You know, they're full of witches and beasts and knights in shining armor. And I thought, if I can do a kind of, what could I say, a kind of modern spin on that, that might be an interesting exercise. But then I began to think a lot about the world of that period. And I came to think that this is a golden age in the West, obviously, the High Renaissance, but it's also a golden age in India with the height of the Mughal Empire. And historically, those two worlds had very little to do with each other. I mean, they were only just beginning to become aware of each other.
Where did Marco Polo fit in?
Well, Marco Polo's earlier, but didn't really go this way. You know, I mean, he went up into China. The contacts there were that Vasco da Gama had arrived in South India at the end of the 15th century in what is now Kerala. There was the beginnings of the spice trade. And the Portuguese had arrived in Goa and had formed their little colony there. But in the north of India, where the Mughal Empire was based, there was very, very little contact. There was the odd merchant, the odd traveler. As far as I could find out, there was no traveler who went in the opposite direction. There was no Indian Marco Polo who arrived in Western Europe at all. And so I thought, let me try and invent the thing that didn't happen.
And you chose a particular period in time. Do we have a year for, in your own mind, and you don't mention it in the book, and of course the book's magic realism anyway.
There are dates in my head. There are two moments. You know, the story begins, as you know, with the arrival of this European-looking, fair-haired, good-looking traveler at the Mughal court. And that would be at the time that Akbar, the emperor, is about 40 years old. So we're talking here about the second half of the 16th century. He came to the throne at 14, so this would be 26 years later, which would be about like the 1570s would be that point. But he then comes to tell the emperor a story about his alleged relationship to the emperor, and he's claiming kinship with him because he says that a lost great aunt of the emperor found her way through the various vicissitudes into Renaissance Italy, and he is descended from her. Now, that part of the story takes place really at the end of the 15th century and into the beginning of the 16th century, so it's like the turn of the century.
At what point did Savonarola?
Savonarola has a guest appearance in the novel. I mean, he really comes in really in order to be burned. The period of the Italian part of the novel is more or less the period of the life of Machiavelli. And Savonarola was around when Machiavelli was a young man, a young boy of about 10 or 11 is when he was in charge for those 4 years when Florentines were obliged to give up their hedonistic ways and be puritanical.
Which is the opening of the story within the story.
And then they burn him and they get back to having fun.
The relationship of metaphor to an actual story, when you're working in this field, in the field of fantasy / historical fiction, and metaphor comes up, how conscious are the metaphors for you as you're writing them?
Sometimes they are. I mean, sometimes I know what I'm doing, and sometimes I find out what I've done after I've done it. And then I forget. You know, so by the end of the book, I can't remember which is which. I can't remember which are the ones that I did on purpose and which are the ones that I did by accident and then realized I'd done. And I just end up pretending that I did it all on purpose.
The motifs of twins, east, west, mirror image.
Well, the mirroring was very conscious because it was kind of a surprise to me as I did the reading for this book, how many mirrorings I found. I mean, how many echoes, because, you know, one assumes that these two worlds were extremely unlike each other. You know, the Christian world of Renaissance Florence, the Muslim and Hindu world of Mughal India, as I say, with very little actual interchange between them. You assume they're very alien from each other. And yet I found all kinds of behavior patterns and even ideas that the two worlds had in common. You know, so that, for example, that these were both very hedonistic cultures. You know, the Mughals famously overindulged in opium from the kings downwards through the court. And it meant that the court was a very pleasure-addicted kind of, you know, sin-seeking place. And then you go to the High Renaissance and you discover something very similar going on. I mean, it's not opium. It's more likely to be wine. But there's plenty of intoxication and plenty of, let's say, exaggerated sexual behavior of homosexual as well as heterosexual. I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that this is a period in Italy in which open gay behavior became very, very prevalent. And it's the openness that interested me because, you know, we think about the Renaissance and we think about this very elegant world of painting and music and, you know, sculpture and fashion and, you know, great palaces and so on and so on. What I found was another rather kind of raunchier street world. You know, this is a city where everything happened out on the street. Everybody was always out on the sidewalk. You know, all the transactions, whether they were mercantile or sexual, were all happening on the street, quite in public. You know, so a very public city. And I found that very unlike the place that I'd originally imagined, you know, and so I found myself writing about that display. And then when I saw that kind of sexual openness was happening in both worlds, I thought there's a reason for deliberately mirroring those things. I mean, deliberately creating echoes.
Well, I noticed in both worlds, certainly the relationship of those in power and the sexual goings on the street. Savonarola comes along and suddenly people are being, you know, running for their lives, yeah, basically. Yeah. And Akbar, the Mughal emperor, at his end is kind of controlling what's going on in the street as well.
Yes, I mean, I think it's very interesting about Akbar because on the one hand, he is this very tolerant, open-minded man who, you know, is not a religious bigot and who seeks to create a kind of inclusive world rather than an exclusive one. And yet, of course, he is also a despot. He's not interested in ceasing to be a tyrant. You know, he's very content to be an absolute ruler and actually has courtiers encouraging him constantly to think of himself literally as God. You know, a temptation he more or less resisted, but not at all a democrat, if you like. So he's this very conflicted figure, and that, of course, makes him very interesting to write about. You know, a tolerant man who is also a tyrant.
Which is historical, then.
Yes, very largely. I mean, there's little bits of the, you know, there's a long internal argument that he has with himself about power and about the nature of goodness and whether you can be a prince through kindness, you know, or whether only cruelty works or whatever, you know. And again, that is a kind of echo of the kind of thinking going on in the head of Niccolo Machiavelli across the world. And some of that, in Akbar's case, some of that is historically justified, I think, and some of it is me putting in his head such thoughts as I think he should have.
At what point, Salman Rushdie, did you stop researching and start writing?
Yeah, it's an important question, that, because I think you have to reach the point where you can put the research to one side. I mean, otherwise, it burdens you, like, you know, carrying heavy suitcases through the book. There was a moment, actually, when I was in India, I went to Fatehpur Sikri, which is the capital that I'm talking about, which Akbar built.
It's ruins now.
It's kind of pretty, I mean, a lot of it is still standing up, you know, but it's this abandoned kind of ghost town, red sandstone ghost town in the middle of nowhere. It's about an hour outside Agra by car. And it's very haunting and evocative. When you walk around it, you can easily feel the presence of the phantom world, you know, that used to inhabit it. And I went there before I started writing the book. I mean, I've been there many times in my life, but I went there having done all the research and saw it through the eyes of all that new information, walked around it and tried to imagine which rooms my characters would be in and how they would get from here to there and, you know, how it would go. And there was a moment at the end of the couple of days I spent there when everything suddenly went click in my head, you know, and I just thought, okay, I got it. And I said to this friend of mine, another Indian writer who was accompanying me, I said, look, you know, if you want to stay, let's stay because it's a really lovely place and so on. But for my purposes, I'm done. You know, and I really felt it like that day very clearly. I thought, I've got this now. I can now put all the books to one side, and I can just write the story.
How long were you doing the research then?
Well, on and off for a while, because, you know, I had the idea for this book back in 1999.
Oh, really?
And clearly didn't have the level of information required to write it. And so I thought, look, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write whatever I'm writing, and in such spare time as I have, I'm going to quietly read myself in. And so while I was writing Fury, while I was writing Shalimar the Clown, I was also reading about the 16th century. And then when I finished Shalimar the Clown, which I guess was just something over 3 years ago, I then spent a year and a half of full-time research, and for the first time in my life used a research assistant as well. And then it took me about a year and a half after that to write the book.
In terms of research, you go to Florence also?
I went to Florence also, although I have to say that Florence the place was less evocative than Fateh Pur Sikri the place, because Florence has changed more. You know, the thing about an abandoned ghost town is that it's very easy to see the ghosts. You know, but when you have a bustling modern city, it's a little less easy. I mean, obviously there are famous landmark buildings that were useful, and the art was very useful. You know, because the thing about Renaissance painting is that if you look in the corners of the pictures, you see pictures of everyday life. You know, if you look away from the Mona Lisa, you know, into the bottom right-hand corner, you see, I mean, actually don't remember if it's in that picture, but you see, like, somebody selling bread, you know.
Right.
And one of the most interesting books I read was a scholarly book, which did exactly that, which took details from corners of Renaissance paintings in order to make a portrait of everyday life. Say, here's somebody selling, you know, meat. Here's a fruit vendor. You know, this is a clothes shop, etc. So if you actually want to look at how people led their ordinary daily life, where they went shopping and how they got through their day, you can find that in Renaissance art by looking away from the subject of the picture, you know, into these details.
When you're doing that kind of research, I mean, one of the great mysteries, because it's not written about, is the lives of women during history itself. Mm-hmm. How do you find out what the life of, say, someone living in a woman living in the Mughal court is like?
Well, there's surprisingly ample information,
really?
As it happens. You know, a lot of the women in the Mughal court were anything but shrinking violets. I mean, so these were all, you know, many of them princesses of very powerful houses themselves, who had made, if you like, a political alliance. The marriage was a political alliance. I mean, for instance, the woman who was the main queen of the Emperor Akbar, not the imaginary queen in the novel, but the really existing main queen, was in her own right a considerable businesswoman. She had a number of merchant ships, and her fleet of ships would trade as far as the Red Sea, and in her own name, I mean, not on behalf of her husband. So she was quite the entrepreneur. And there's another group, and for instance, there is actually a bit of the novel where Akbar's aunt, Princess Gulbadan, whose name means rose-bodied, decides she wants to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. You know, this is a woman in the middle of the 16th century deciding she wants to go across the world. And what's more, she manages then to persuade a number of the other great ladies of the court that they want to go too. And this is a historical fact, that this group of Mughal dignitaries, princesses, made this two-year journey to the holy places of Islam and back. And it shows that there were amongst those women some very intrepid women. And that gave me permission, I felt, to try and invent a woman who was also pretty intrepid, you know, who was not by any means a kind of wallflower.
And she, though, the enchantress, the hidden princess, she's totally fictional.
She's totally fictional, but her sister wasn't. I mean, that's to say, there's a true story with which it begins. When Akbar's grandfather, the first Mughal emperor, Babur, before he'd ever established the kingdom in India, when he was just what we would now call an Uzbek warlord, was besieged in the city of Samarkand on the Silk Route by a rival warlord. And the rival warlord knew that he, Babur, had a very beautiful sister, and said to him, if you want to get out of this place safely and alive, the price of your safety is that you surrender to me your beautiful sister, which he did, and was always rather embarrassed about it. Now, in real life, what happened is that later on, that particular warlord also got defeated, and his vanquisher returned Babur's sister to her family. And so in real life, she went home and lived happily ever after. But it just gave me the idea of how a woman might become detached from her own world and begin to be, first as a spoil of war, begin to sort of move across the world. So in the novel, I invented a second sister. the title character of the novel, and she's totally fictitious.
How did you come up with her name?
Well, there is poetry that exists in the Turkic languages in which there's a repeated image of the beloved as having black eyes. Right, so this image of the black-eyed beauty to whom the poet addresses his love songs. And Kara Koz, that's what it means. Kara means black, Koz means eyes, so she's called Black Eyes. That's where the name came from. It came out of the poetry of the period, really.
And the decision to have her pseudonym be Angelica?
Well, that's partly, it's stolen a little bit from Ariosto, because in his great narrative poem, Orlando Furioso, there is the story there of an Indian princess arriving in Europe and making trouble, and everybody thinks she's a witch and so on. Ariosto knew very little about India, so he calls her the Princess of India and Cathay, which, of course, there's no such place, and he calls her Angelica because he doesn't know any Indian names. So in my novel, I decided, and the point about Ariosto's poem is that it's written at exactly the time I'm writing about, even though the story he's telling, he sets many hundreds of years earlier. He sets it in the time of Charlemagne and, you know, so on and so on. But it's written at this time. So I thought, okay, maybe when she falls in love with her Italian soldier of fortune who brings her back to Italy, he can't pronounce her name. You know, he can't pronounce this outlandish name from the East, Kara Koz. And so he decides, I'm going to call you Angelica. So I sort of stole the name from Ariosto.
When you're talking about things like that, how much of that is serendipitous? Oh, hey, I could use this. And how much of it is deliberate on your part?
Well, a lot of it is serendipitous. You know, I mean, for instance, I had worked out the idea of this princess completely oblivious of the fact that the Ariosto poem talks about an Indian princess arriving. And so when I read it, I was first of all deeply amazed to find that somebody had got there 400 years before me. You know, and secondly, I thought, okay, good. Well, it kind of feels like a pat on the back and telling me I'm going in the right direction. You know, it sort of gave me permission to do it.
You're listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is The Enchantress of Florence. We're talking before about metaphors and the use of metaphors, including, of course, the fact that our hero is blonde and this darker world, and we're talking about the melding of two cultures, which goes back through all of your work and through your own life as well. What did you find afterward that you know you didn't consciously do?
For instance, I think that one of the great happy discoveries of the book was the New World. I mean, that's to say the New World is being discovered
at
this time. And for a long time, in planning the book and beginning to write it, I had no idea that that world, this new place across the what was then called the Ocean Sea, the Atlantic Ocean, that would in any way affect my story. But I had a problem which I needed to resolve in the story, which when I started out, I didn't quite know how to resolve, which is that this girl, Kara Koz, this lost princess, yes, she's making these choices. She's jumping from man to man, you know, and she's gradually moving across the world. Firstly, not through her choice, but afterwards, yes, through her own volition, you know. But the poignancy of that is what she's doing is burning her bridges as she goes, and she can't go home again. And the only piece of home that she has is this slave girl that she brings along with her, who she calls her mirror, who is the only person who really understands her and knows where she came from and who she really is. And I thought, how sad it is that as she grows up, grows older, and more isolated from her place of beginning, that her need to find a way home becomes more and more an anguish to her. And I thought, but I can't send her back the way she came because, you know, there's no way back. And then the discovery of the New World, I thought, well, you know, this would be, if you like, for her, a kind of despairing move, that she could go that way in order to try and make the circumnavigation, you know, that people had been talking about at a time when the route hadn't been found. You know, the route across to the Indies had not been found. But she, hopefully, and, you know, more in despair than anything else, decides that that's what she has to do. She has to go the long way around. And so that arrival of America into the later part of the book was for me just a complete delight because it was completely unforeseen until quite a long way into the writing of the book. And that image of the New World, you know, after all, it was a kind of metaphor. You know, the New World wasn't entirely real to people at that time. You could only imagine the explosion in one's mind if one discovered suddenly that the planet one lived on was not the shape one thought it was, that it was actually twice as big as you had suspected, and that there was this colossal place that had just showed up, you know, that nobody knew existed. And as you know, Columbus never really understood that. Columbus lived and died thinking he'd reached the Indies. But soon afterwards, you know, in the time of Amerigo Vespucci and so on, people began to be aware that this really was a new world. And it, you know, that the term new world, of course, doesn't only apply to the new world that was discovered. The world had become new for everyone, you know, because it had changed shape. Imagine that kind of existential, the drama of discovering that you don't know the shape your own planet is. And that everything, if you like, has become fluid. Things which you believe to be fixed, you know, like the shape of the world, are no longer fixed. I mean, that makes it, in some ways, a very creative time, you know, because it's a world in which the rules break down.
Which is why Swift can write something like Gulliver's Travels, yes. Because there are those huge invisible spaces.
Exactly, exactly. So that I used in the novel the new world like a fantastic space, like a space that's still coming into being, you know, and because in the imaginations of Europeans, that's what was happening. People didn't know the rules of that world, you know. Maybe time moved differently. Maybe people were completely unlike anybody they'd ever heard of. Who knew? There was just a mystery there. And to be able to just allow that mystery to infect the later stages of the novel was very helpful.
It also creates, again, an unreliable geography that ties in with the unreliable narrator.
That's exactly right. And that, it's wonderfully well put. I think that the unreliable geography of the book is, I think, a real part of the kind of feeling that the book tries to create, which is of a world which is not reliable.
As you're working on something like that, and again, coming back to the idea of conscious and unconscious metaphors. I mean, we think we live in a reliable world now, but we don't.
No, I don't. I think that's exactly right. And some of, you know, it's been interesting to me is for listening to some of the earliest readers of the book, how much they identify that as the thing that they connect to in their own experience. You know, that's, I mean, it's easy to connect certain other aspects, you know, as we were saying, East-West clashes and wars and battles and brutality and torture and so on. I mean, that stuff's easy. But I've been interested and kind of gratified to see that what people have really responded to as something that speaks to them about their lives now is that uncertainty, you know, that the world is not a solid place, that you can't trust it. And that, I think, is a feeling I was really trying to create.
You have three characters, Machiavelli, Ago Vespucci, and Argalia, who winds up being a great Turkish general. Was there an Argalia?
No, Argalia is the one that's made up. I mean, he's completely imagined, and he becomes, you know, the hero of the novel. He's the one who falls in love with the enchantress, and you know, etc. The other two are both real. I believe the portrait of Machiavelli in the book to be substantially like what he was really like. In that sense, I've been quite scrupulous to try and present him as I believe him really to have been. Agostino Vespucci, a member of the very large Vespucci family, a distant relative of Amerigo Vespucci, was a historical figure who was a clerk who worked with Machiavelli in what was called the Second Chancery, which was essentially the Foreign Ministry of Florence. And so they were, if you like, diplomats together. Not that much is known about him historically, and I had to largely make up his character. I mean, we know that he was a close friend and drinking buddy of Machiavelli's. There's this amazing way in which after the book he suddenly bubbled up from history. Because I don't know if you remember, a couple of months ago there was a news story from Florence about how they had finally conclusively identified the woman in the Mona Lisa. You know, that people had always suspected it was this girl, Mona Lisa del Giocondo, but there was no absolute proof. Anyway, they found a document in the archives of the city in which a clerk had written in the corner of this document the identifier of who is the woman in the painting, and identifying that it, in fact, was Mona Lisa. The amazing thing is that the clerk who did this was Agostino Vespucci. So suddenly, having created him and spent these years with him, he kind of bubbled up into the news and identified the Mona Lisa, and I felt proud of him.
Salman Rushdie, I want to change gears for a second. You are developing an acting career. You were in a movie called Then She Found Me? I mean, you've been an extra before. I've seen you in, you know, parties.
But. Well, I had a very little guest appearance playing myself in Bridget Jones's Diary, which was only because the author of the book, Helen Fielding, is an old pal of mine and called me out. I think if I remember her words exactly, she said, "How would you like to make a fool of yourself?" So I said, "Oh, all right," and went and did that. And it was kind of fun. This was much more surprising to me because it really came out of the blue. I mean, Helen Hunt, who stars in the movie and directed it, I mean, I didn't know her, you know, until I was in the film. So I just got a call from the casting agents saying that they'd be interested to have me do this part of playing her OBGYN, you know. So I was flattered, of course, and I asked to see the script, and I liked the script because the script had a quality which I like in writing, that it could make very quick switches between comedy and sadness, etc. There could be quite quick, swift glides between one mood and another mood, and I thought, that's good, you know. So I thought, okay, you know, I'll have a go. And it was the most fun. I had an urge when I was a young person to be an actor. I mean, when I was a college student, I did quite a bit of acting. And immediately afterwards, on the fringe in London, went on for a bit before I decided to concentrate on this other form of work that I was interested in, which seemed to go all right, you know. But I always felt a little sadness about not having pursued that career. And I've written a lot about actors. You know, the Satanic Verses, the central characters are both actors. So I think it's kind of strange if in my 60s I get to do the thing I couldn't do in my 20s.
Did you have any problem with remembering the lines?
No. It was all right. In fact, I was a bit nervous about it because I didn't want to make an idiot of myself in front of such distinguished actors. I mean, it's, you know, Bette Midler, Matthew Broderick, Colin Firth, and Helen Hunt. I mean, it's a remarkable cast. And I didn't want to be the person messing things up, you know. So I'm happy that I kind of got away with it, I think.
How many days did you work?
Just two very long days. Very long days. This was a low-budget independent movie. Everybody is working for scale and kind of pitching in there. And we worked until, you know, close to midnight both days.
Did you get a chance to see the film?
I have seen the film, yeah, and I think it's pretty good. I really can't watch myself. I mean, I can't even watch myself when I do a TV interview. I have a tendency to cover my eyes when I see myself come on screen, but I think it's all right.
Salman Rushdie, it's now been quite a long time since the era of the fatwa. Do you think you've finally put it behind you? I couldn't tell whether there's anything in Enchantress of Florence that even remotely relates to the emotional stress you went through.
No, not really. The only time it crops up now, you know, is when I'm doing interviews, really. And that's because I think it's somehow in the mind of journalists, it's still there. It's still like when I show up, it's a thing they think about. I mean, not surprisingly, it was a big news event. And I think also in the mind of people who have never read a book of mine, it may be the first thing they know about me. So in that sense, it's the albatross around my neck, and I suspect I'll probably never entirely get it off. I always thought the only thing I can do is just go on writing books and gradually push that event further and further and further into the past. I mean, this year, you know, it's 20 years since the publication of the Satanic Verses. It's really getting to be a very long time ago. You know, that was my fifth book. It was my fourth novel. This is my 10th novel, my 11th work of fiction, if you include the book of short stories. So I feel that it's ancient history. You know, and as I say, in my ordinary daily life, it feels like ancient history.
We spoke a moment ago about your acting career. What about writing for theater?
All I've ever done is to adapt or to help adapt a couple of my novels for the stage. Let's say Haroon and the Sea of Stories was done a while ago by the National Theatre in London, and I worked with the director to make a version of it for the stage. And I thought the production was actually magical. I mean, it's Tim Supple who directed it, but just did the most spectacular job.
Is that the one that appeared in Berkeley Rep?
That's right. A few years ago, Berkeley Rep restaged it. But I mean, completely restaged it. It was a different production. And I also wrote a stage adaptation of Midnight's Children, which the Royal Shakespeare Company did about 4 years ago, I guess. And that was in London, and then it had been partly financed by the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor and also partly financed by Columbia University. So we were able to bring it to America and have it on in Ann Arbor for a bit and on, amazingly, the Apollo Theater in Harlem for a bit.
Wasn't Haroon an opera, too?
Yes. That's also happened that the American composer Charles Warren made an opera out of it with a brilliant libretto by James Fenton. And I just heard, he's obviously got the taste for adapting books, because I just heard he's doing Brokeback Mountain.
As an opera,
yeah.
How come you think, insofar as I know, none of your books have become films?
I know. It's a strange thing. Many of them, I mean, there have been a lot of nibbles without anybody actually taking the hook, you know. I mean, actually too superstitious even to talk about it much, but there seems to be a quite good possibility of a serious attempt to make a film of Midnight's Children. So, you know, with good people involved.
Have you ever thought of working on screenplays yourself?
Yes. I mean, actually, I feel it's kind of crazy, given that I love movies and that I'm sort of a movie nerd, you know, that I've never worked in that way for the cinema. But what I'd like to do, and I think it's the thing that for a writer makes it a satisfying experience, is to have, let's say, a good relationship with a particular director and make a thing with them. You know, Hanif Qureshi and Stephen Frears, when they made My Beautiful Laundrette, were very happy working together. Paul Auster and Wayne Wang, when they made Smoke, you know, similarly, they enjoyed the relationship. And I think for a writer, the key is that, is to have a creative partner that you really want to do it with.
Do you have anybody in mind?
I have one or two, yeah. I have one or two. And there have been the beginnings of conversations. But I mean, I wouldn't like to, you know, to never have done it. So I would like to have a go.
You finished Enchantress of Florence, and you have this nascent acting career, if you want to call it that. What's on tap for you? What are you planning on?
I mean, I do have another grown-up novel sort of slightly on the back burner, but immediately I think what I have to do is write a children's book, because my younger son is now just turned 11 and read Haroon and the Sea of Stories and is very keen for me to do a book that's for him, you know, as in the way that book was for his older brother. And I think I've just found out where the book might be in my head, you know. And once I finish with this book tour in another few weeks, I think that's the thing I'm going to try and do right away.
Well, you mentioned before that you've been thinking about and doing the research on Enchantress of Florence. Are you doing research for one?
No, because I'm really anxious to write a book that requires no research at all. I mean, this novel, Enchantress, required a lot. Charlemagne the Clown before it required quite a bit. And so I spent a lot of the last many years doing my homework. And I really want to write a book that doesn't need me to do any homework.
You've been listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is The Enchantress of Florence. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.